Humans, throughout time, have always been a creature of ritual. It's ritual that sets an event apart from the monotony of daily life. It's what brings meaning and importance. It's what allows us to feel dedication, empowerment, safety, and even appreciation. Ritual is also what allows us to feel a deeper connection with life, providing a means of reflection, to savor its special moments and embrace its fragility. It's the rituals associated with the latter that seem to require the most planning, a final, elaborate display of a life lived before it is soon forgotten. Throughout the world, funerary rituals are often the most strictly adhered to, emotionally powered, and often the most financially draining for the families playing host to them. It's an elaborate display of sorrow and fear. Sorrow for what has been lost, and fear of what death represents, the great unknown, uncertainty. It's that uncertainty of what lies beyond that makes being in the presence of the corpse so uncomfortable. The waxy-looking figure laid out on display reminds us of our own mortality and frightens us with the finality of death. It leads us to question, what lies beyond the darkness? It's that uncertainty that seems to shake us to our very core. It's that chilling uncertainty that makes us seek the comfort of ritual, to gain a sense of peace and empowerment from it. The ritual often serves the purpose of attempting to provide us with the answers we seek, to show us that there is something beyond, that some part of us does live on. The ritual affirms this by honoring the spirit of the deceased, ensuring that they feel the love and appreciation needed in order for them to peacefully move on. All of our modern funerary rituals are based off of the belief that spirits needed this in order to move on. It sounds compassionate, like a final act of goodwill towards the deceased. However, in actuality, funerary rituals were more commonly based off of fear. Fear of the newly deceased. Many cultures throughout history believed that if the deceased were not given a formal sending off, their spirits would remain trapped in this realm. The funeral was a way to appease the spirit, so it didn't remain on this earth, tormenting the living. We not only feared death itself, we also feared the dead. So many of our modern funerary customs have ancient and often superstitious roots. The flowers that often surround the dead is custom that goes back to ancient times, all the way back to even the Stone Age. Flowers often served a dual purpose, as both an offering to the dead and appeasement, and also as a means of masking the scent of decay. Many times, the type of flower and the fragrance associated had various spiritual associations with it, often serving the dual purpose of a token of appeasement and also a method of binding the dead to their graves. A lot of the ways in which the dead are presented during the funerary ritual are symbolic as well. In ancient times, a funeral also served as a protection ritual. It was a way to ensure that the dead remained just that, the eyes of the deceased would be closed as a way to close the window between the living and the spirit world. In many places, it's tradition to cover mirrors and open windows and doors in the household after a death, so that the spirit will be able to move on and not remain trapped. It's also still custom in many countries that the deceased is removed from the home, feet first, so that the spirit will be unable to look back into the household and beckon another family member to the other side. Throughout history, we have put a lot of work into ensuring that the dead remain just that. There is no greater example of this than the cemetery itself. Tombstones do more than just serve as a monument and marker. They were also used as a means of spirit entrapment. It stemmed from the belief that, like with material objects, spirits could also be pinned down by heavy objects. The act of ringing bells, wailing, beating on the coffin or grave, firing of guns, have all been used by many cultures as a way of chasing or scaring away the spirits of the dead. All of the funerary rituals served the unifying purpose of ensuring that the dead moved on. It was very important to all involved that the dead did not linger long in this world. For if they did, those restless spirits could cause great harm to the living. It was believed that the dead, if left unchecked, would torment, possess, and even consume the living. These spirits were often known as the undead. All around the world, there are a plethora of legends and folk tales of such things. Every culture has some sort of tale about the dead coming back, often being the harbingers of death themselves. It's been the center of many of our superstitions and even some of our holidays. The fear of the dead and the horrors they could bring about on the living was a very real thing. Even today, there are still many cultures and religions which believe in this very thing. And for many, the dead returning and bringing suffering to the living is still something that happens. In today's terms, we often think of zombies when we think of the word undead. In fact, legends and tales of zombies are surprisingly universal, and they seem a commonality across cultures. Zombies date back to ancient Mesopotamia and are mentioned in the Epic of Gilgamesh. In the tale, Ishtar threatens to knock down the gates of the netherworld, smash the doorposts, and leave the doors flat down, so that to let the dead rise up and eat the living. Every culture has some sort of story about the dead coming back and, in some fashion or another, preying on the living. In China, there is the Guangxi, or hopping corpse. The Guangxi are very similar to the zombies of modern-day pop culture. They are the reanimated dead, driven by instinct alone. The Guangxi are said to be the dead of those who perished far from home, and they're bound to wander the earth until they return to their homeland. Only then can they achieve peace and rest. Now, unlike the zombies of television and film, the Guangxi do not feast on the living. In Scandinavian mythology, there were the Draugr. The Norse were well known as being ferocious in battle and were often some of the strongest and merciless warriors. It was said that these warriors were so fierce, so relentless in battle, that not even death itself could stop them. If slain during battle, the warriors would rise again as the Draugr. These undead warriors, bloodthirsty and seeking vengeance, would roam the lands and slay all those who crossed their path. The only way to defeat these undead warriors was to remove the head or burn the body. In many cases, it was believed both actions were necessary. It's said that the fear of the Draugr was behind the Viking funerary ritual of burning the dead out at sea. In Arabia, there was the ghoul. The ghoul was often a spirit that had become trapped on this earth, similar to a djinn, and they would often inhabit graveyards. Ghouls were known to be flesh-eating monstrosities. They would either rob the graves of their corpses and eat the dead, or they would inhabit the corpses, using them as a means of bait, a way of tricking the living to come closer to them. And once within reach, the ghoul would attack and feast upon the flesh of the living. In Germany, there is the Nachtsitter. It's believed that if a person commits suicide or suffers a sudden or traumatic death, and the proper funerary or religious rites aren't performed, their spirit will not move on and it will remain attached to the body. If the spirit remains attached for too long, they will become a Nachtsitter. The corpse will reanimate, and then it'll begin to feed upon itself, tearing off large pieces of its own flesh. Once its initial hunger has been satisfied, it would then begin feeding off of the life force of its family members, causing those it was feeding off of to weaken and become ill. Once the Nachtsitter was strong enough, it would leave its grave at nightfall, shape-shifting into the form of a pig so that it would go unnoticed. It would then seek out the living, attacking and feasting on them. Now, I know the idea of a zombie piggy is oddly adorable, and let's face it, incredibly amusing, but the Nachtsitter were quite fearsome. They were also known as the bringers of death. And in between feedings, they would climb up bell towers and ring the bells. And those who heard the bells rung by the Nachtsitter would die shortly afterwards. Now, though powerful, these beasts could be destroyed. And the method of choice to destroy the horrid beast was to decapitate it. There were also ways you could prevent a corpse from turning into one. A customary funerary ritual was to place a heavy object over the corpse's mouth, such as a stone or sometimes ornately decorated pieces of metal. The theory was that if the Nachtsitter could not complete the first step of feeding on its own flesh, it would be unable to make the full transition, thus unable to hunt and harm the living. While many have feared these spirits and the things they are capable of, there have always been those who have sought to control them. Those versed in the art of necromancy, who could wield a special power over the dead, had the ability to contain and enslave these spirits. There's a shared belief amongst a variety of cultures that the spirits of the newly deceased are incredibly vulnerable. If they do not immediately move on in those first few days after passing over, they are weak and confused, which can make them perfect prey for dark magicians or sorcerers and witch doctors who could snatch these spirits up and entrap them. Once these spirits are caught, they're bound to and forced to do the bidding of their masters, often being called upon to perform unsavory tasks, such as murder. Sometimes, the spirits are forced to inhabit or take possession of a person or a corpse to perform their work. One of the oldest tales of such is the Vatala of India. The Vatala are spirits of those who remain trapped in an agonizing state of unrest due to the fact that they were denied the proper funerary rites. This lack of appeasement and protection would cause the spirits to turn into monstrous creatures, who would then torment and feed upon the flesh of the living. They remain trapped in this sinister state until the proper funerary rites are performed. However, due to their state of torment, the Vatala are also very vulnerable and would often be entrapped and enslaved by sorcerers. And when this happens, they're forced to inhabit either their body or that of a freshly buried corpse. During this entrapped state, they're bound to the sorcerer and forced to do their bidding, often used for killing and obtaining human parts for rituals. Entrapped Vatala were confined to caves or underground dwellings during the day, but after nightfall, were forced to roam and carry out their master's bidding. Most often, they were put in charge of killing children and livestock, the parts of which would often be used during necromancy rituals. Now, the Vatala aren't the only tales of this form of spirit entrapment. The most common and most well-known legends and folklore involving the undead is the traditional zombie of voodoo. The word zombie comes from the Congo word for soul. And to acquire a zombie, it is all about using the soul. In voodoo, it's believed that death comes in two forms: natural, as in sickness or old age, and unnatural, like a sudden accident or a murder. It's believed that the souls or spirits of those who suffer an unnatural death are forced to linger at the grave. They must stay on earth, unable to join their ancestors until they receive the approval of the gods. They're basically stuck in a form of purgatory. The spirits are even unable to wander far from the grave. They're still bound to their bodies. While in this state of waiting, these spirits, especially new spirits, are incredibly vulnerable, and they can be captured by a bokor or witch doctor. Often the bokor collects the souls in bottles and uses them for various tasks. The spirits are bound and remain in servitude to the bokor until they are either set free or the bokor dies. Bokors are said to raid graveyards during the night, capturing the spirits of the newly deceased. These are the preferred spirits, as the bokor can use the captured spirit to create a zombie. Fresh spirits are always best for this task. The spirit is also still able to inhabit its body, and it remains solely under the control of the bokor. This reanimated corpse has no will of its own and must do as it is told. Now, not all the spirits that are collected by a bokor are taken against their will. Sometimes a deal is made between the bokor and the spirit. Instead of having to endure that torture of listless waiting, the spirit willingly agrees to become a zombie, seeing it as a very welcome way to bide the time. Typically, these zombies are used in healing magic, or kind of as butlers to help with household chores. Bokoras and zombies are definitely considered on the fringe of the voodoo religion, something that exists primarily in the societal underground. In fact, most practitioners of voodoo view the idea of the zombie as folklore, really as a metaphor for the horrors of slavery. Those who do believe in zombies do not find the zombies themselves as something to be feared. The zombie itself is viewed with pity, as it's merely an entrapped creature, robbed of all free thought and willpower. Whether you believe in the tales of entrapped spirits, forced to re-inhabit their bodies and live in servitude, or not, there is some truth to the voodoo of zombie. And it's far more sinister, and honestly, far more terrifying. Many times, Bokors will zombify and enslave the living. Even more terrifying is that they're often paid by the person's own family to do so. It is not uncommon for a Bokor to be approached by someone who wants revenge or rid of someone else. After the person agreed to pay the Bokor's hefty service fee, the Bokor would then do that person's bidding. A special drug would be concocted, which would, by all accounts, make the target appear dead. The drug is known as zombie power, and it's made using a variety of neurotoxins extracted from the pufferfish, cane toad, and the poisonous frog, the hyla. Most often, human bone was ground up into the mixture as well. The powder was often poured inside of the target's shoes, where it would go unnoticed and easily be absorbed by the skin. However, sometimes it was slipped into the target's food or drink as well. Now, once the target had absorbed the toxins, they would soon fall ill and soon become unconscious. Their breathing and pulse would be slowed down to the point that it was barely detectable, and the target would, by all accounts, appear dead. After the funeral was held and the seemingly dead person was buried, the Bokor would wait until after nightfall and then exhume the body. The Bokor would then administer an antidote for the toxins and revive the person. He would then offer the person, who would be extremely thirsty upon awakening, a drink of water, which would be laced with a less potent version of the zombie powder. This would put that person in a trance-like state, keeping them in a state of amnesia as well. In this state, the person is unable to think clearly for themselves, and they're easily controlled. In essence, they are a zombie. The zombie would then essentially become the Bokor's property. It would be used for hard labor and also as a means for intimidation for those who cross the Bokor. The zombies would remain in the Bokor's service until their debt was considered paid, or punishment complete. Or when the Bokor was no longer around to keep administering that daily dose of the drug. Now, as odd as it sounds, this is something that happens. And the threat of it is so great that it's something that is addressed in Haitian law. Article 249 makes the turning of an individual into a zombie a criminal offense. And there have been many cases over the years of people claiming to have been former zombies. But the most notable was a case from 1980. In 1980, there was an article published about a man who claimed that for several years, he had lived on a Bocor's farm as a zombie. His name was Clarivius Nerisi, and he claimed that he had been captured and zombified against his will. Now, the thing about this type of zombie is often this person is zombified because the people around them don't like them. Typically, communities will get together and approach a Bocor for his help in order to get rid of a troublesome person. So most of the people who get zombified in this way weren't exactly very nice people. And if there ever was a candidate for someone having a Bocor-style hit placed on them, it would have been Clarivius. Clarivius was not well-liked by his family or the community. And to be honest, he was a downright jerk. He would often quarrel with his brother over who should have a larger piece of their father's inheritance, often within earshot of their still very living father. Now, this in itself was considered an unsavory social taboo, and it caused most of his family to stop speaking to him. Clarivius was also a womanizer and had children by many different women, all of whom he refused to marry or support. And often, as soon as they became pregnant, he would cast them aside, refusing to speak with them. He never acknowledged any of his children. Now, since he had managed to shuck any and all social responsibility, Clarivius was able to save up a tidy sum of money. Money which he never shared, and money which he spent solely on himself. Even while his children lived a life of poverty, often going hungry. The truth is, just about everybody in the community hated Clarivius and wanted him gone. It's said that one day in 1962, members of the community gathered together to discuss what should be done about this troublesome man. It was during this meeting that one member spoke up and said that he knew a Bocor who would gladly make this problem of Clarivius go away for the right price. It was members of Clarivius's own family who ended up contacting and paying the Bocor, who then swiftly carried out his task. Now, on April 30th of 1962, Clarivius began feeling unwell. It was a sickness that came on suddenly, and by that evening, he had admitted himself to the hospital. Now, at first, it seemed to the staff that it was nothing more than a case of the flu. He had a fever, complained of aches, and generally felt lethargic and unwell. However, his condition only worsened, and by the next morning, he began spitting up blood. And from there, he rapidly declined, going into a coma. And then, on May 2nd, he was declared dead. Only one member of his family came to the hospital to be by his side, his younger sister, Angelina. After Clarivius was pronounced dead, Angelina immediately notified the rest of the family. She was shocked by the fact that none seemed terribly broken up by the passing of Clarivius. And poor Angelina practically had to beg for one of them to come to the hospital and help sign the death certificate. A while later, the elder sister, Marie Claire, arrived to the facility to formally identify the body and sign the death certificate. The body was then placed in cold storage in the hospital morgue for 24 hours. And then, on May 3rd, Clarivius was buried in a small cemetery just north of town. There was no funeral, no celebration of his life, just a hasty burial. And later that night, the Bocor snuck into the graveyard and exhumed the body. He pried open the casket and prepared a concoction that would awaken Clavius, yet keep him in a trance-like state. A few minutes later, Clavius was awake and walking alongside the Bokor, not as a man, but as a zombie. For several years, Clavius was bound to the Bokor, working on his farm. Clavius performed hard labor mainly in the fields, working from sunrise to sunset. He was not the only zombie working on that farm. There were around 100 other zombies there, including several women. Clavius would later recount that during his time as a zombie, he was actually still aware of his surroundings and aware of who he was, but he was unable to communicate or act on free will. He said it felt as though he were floating above his body, watching all that went on. He firmly believed that the Bokor had entrapped his soul and was controlling his body. Things went on like this for several years until 1964, when one of the other zombies stopped eating his daily meals, which were always laced with the drug. And after a few days, the drug began to leave his system, and the man slowly came to. He eventually lashed out at the Bokor in a violent fit of rage, beating and killing him. With the Bokor no longer around to administer the drug, all of the zombies eventually came to and fled. Now for Clavius, it was kind of a bittersweet moment. He was happy to finally be free, but he also knew that he had no one to return to. He knew who had asked the Bokor to turn him into the zombie in the first place. And knowing that his family hated him, and feeling as there was no proper way to repent for his misdeeds, Clavius headed north. And there he stayed for several years, but he was still homesick. So eventually, he moved back south, but made sure to keep a fair bit of distance from the town where he grew up. And for 18 years, he lived this way. But soon, he found that he could take that sadness and heavy heart no more. In 1980, he sought out the only family member who he felt still might have any tenderness for him, his younger sister, Angelina. On a balmy day, a man approached Angelina in the marketplace, claiming to be her dearly departed brother, Clavius. And you can only imagine the shock that poor Angelina must have experienced. And from there, she quizzed him on various aspects of their life, asking him questions that only a family member would know. And indeed, she realized that this was Clavius standing before her. And that is where the story of Clavius stops. And who knows if he ever actually made amends with his family, but it is a good cautionary tale. It's a tale to remind people not to be a jerk because things can always come back to you. Now, Haiti isn't the only place that has these type of zombie stories. New Orleans in the United States is full of these types of stories, of these Bokors capturing spirits and entrapping them. Now, sometimes these Bokors can do something more than just entrap a spirit. Sometimes they're called upon by desperate families to not just entrap the spirit, but to bring the dead back to life. Now, unfortunately, with this type of spirit entrapment, this type of zombification, it never seems to go very well. Unfortunately, when the spirit is captured and put back into the body, it still does not fully return to what it once was. And a popular example of that is the story of Violet the Zombie Child, about a desperate family who tried to bring their little girl back and the horrible things that happened when they did. Robert and Yvette seemed to have it all. Being one of the wealthiest families in all of Old New Orleans, they lived in a lavish home, complete with the finest furnishings and all the comforts that time could bring. Now, they were married when they were both quite young, and Robert and Yvette had a marriage that was envied by most. Robert and Yvette were deeply in love, and those in their presence were often struck by the connection the two of them had with each other. Their lives to outsiders seemed perfect. But Robert and Yvette's lives were void of the one thing they truly wanted, a child. For years, they'd struggled to conceive, but year after year, their family remained incomplete. And with each passing year, poor Yvette seemed more and more heartbroken, and Robert became desperate to ease his wife's pain in any way he could. Now, when it came to Yvette's happiness, Robert spared no expense, and he procured the best doctors and treatments available. It seemed like it was all in vain until Dr. Joseph Gottschalk came into their lives. Now, Gottschalk advertised himself to be a physician, surgeon, occultist, and akasher, or male midwife. Now, Gottschalk, he actually served the couple quite well, and within a few months of his treatments, Yvette became pregnant, and after months of being under the male midwife's care, Yvette gave birth to a beautiful little girl, whom Yvette named Violet, due to the child's striking violet eyes. Now, everyone who came in contact with little Violet was struck by her beauty and immediately seemed to fall under the little child's spell. Their little family was now complete, and Robert and Yvette were over the moon. Yvette held lavish parties and gigantic gatherings in honor of her child, and the wealthiest and most elite members of Old New Orleans were in attendance, and they all brought with them lavish gifts for little Violet. And the guest of honor, Dr. Gottschalk, presented young Violet with a small pair of amethyst earrings, which exactly matched her eyes. Well, as the years passed, little Violet lived a pampered life, doted on and every whim catered to by both her loving parents and her devoted nurse. Now, Violet especially held the attention of her father, who showered his daughter with gifts and love. However, the one thing that Violet wanted from him the most, he couldn't give. You see, Robert's work took him out of town quite frequently, and he'd leave Yvette and young Violet behind for weeks at a time. Sometimes Robert was gone more than he was home. And her father's absences would tear little Violet's world apart. And when she knew he was about to leave for one of his long business trips, little Violet would go into a rage. Her tantrums were often a force to be reckoned with. And Robert soon took to leaving for his trips during the night, after little Violet had fallen asleep. Now, one humid summer's eve, when Violet was now 5, Yvette received notice that her father was gravely ill and expected to pass at any time. Well, devastated, Yvette hurriedly packed her bags and made arrangements for her travels. Now, Yvette decided that it would be best if little Violet stayed behind, as she wanted to spare her young child from such a grim experience. Unfortunately, Yvette's journey coincided with one of Robert's business trips, which made Yvette a bit anxious, as she didn't like the idea of leaving her little daughter separated from both parents, especially for such a long period of time. Now, Robert tried to ease Yvette's worries. He even offered to take little Violet along with him to his trip to Florida. But unfortunately for Robert, this only heightened his wife's frantic state. Now, what Robert didn't realize was that since Violet's birth, Yvette had been plagued with nightmares about her daughter falling into a swamp and developing a fatal fever. The dreams happened so frequently that Yvette was convinced that this was some sort of omen. So she did her best to protect little Violet, oftentimes hardly ever letting her leave the house. So at the idea of Robert taking little Violet to Florida, this put Yvette into a panic. And she knew that those dreams were a warning and that this trip would be disastrous. Yvette begged Robert and tearfully made him swore that he would not bring Violet along with him and that she'd remain safely behind in the care of her nurse. Well, Robert, wanting to make his wife happy, he agreed and he promised that he wouldn't take Violet to Florida with him. And at that, Yvette felt much better and readied for her trip. With her nerves calmed, the next morning, Yvette happily left for her trip, her mind at ease. Well, little Violet took the parting rather well, and she waved goodbye to her mother cheerfully and played in the room with her nurse. Now, unfortunately for Robert, his departure didn't go as smoothly. As soon as little Violet heard that he too was going to be leaving, she threw her most impressive tantrum yet. She threw things. She hit her nurse. She even collapsed to the floor in a tearful rage. Well, the nurse, quite fearful of being left alone with a child in this sort of state, gently coaxed Robert and brought up the idea of why couldn't Violet just go along to Florida with him? Well, feeling pity for his little daughter and distraught by all of her distress, Robert forgot his promise to Yvette and decided that he would bring little Violet along with him to Florida. However, this would have been one of Robert's biggest mistakes. You see, while out during that trip in Florida, little Violet happened to have been playing near a swamp. And as little children do, Violet was curious and she went into the waters. Now, it's not clear if Violet had some sort of accident in the water or maybe she was just swimming around. But within 24 hours, Violet was gravely ill. She had a very high fever and her breathing had become very shallow. And Robert immediately rushed back home with Violet. When they reached the house, the nurse could tell that something was wrong. The way the carriage hastily pulled into the driveway, and then when she saw Robert holding Violet's little limp body in his hands, the nurse went into a panic. She ran out and sat for the doctor. And when Dr. Gostok arrived, he was heartbroken. He knew exactly what had happened. Violet had contracted a fever, and this fever was more than likely scarlet fever. And there was nothing that he could do about it. He told the father the best he could do was make the little one comfortable, but that would be it. And unfortunately, that was true. Only 12 hours later, little Violet was no more. Well, you can imagine the entire household was devastated by this. Robert, the nurse, the doctor, and all the other servants who worked in the house all loved Violet, and they were crushed. Now, the one person who would be even more crushed than this had yet to hear about the news, and that was Violet's mother. And when Yvette returned a few days later, she would get the worst news of her life. When she heard that her young daughter had passed only days after her father had passed, Yvette lost it, and she sank into a deep depression and became absolutely despondent. Yvette would spend all of her time lying in bed. She let herself go, and she was wasting away. Well, Robert didn't know what to do. He too felt as his world had absolutely fallen apart, and he had no idea how either of them could go on without their darling little Violet. And then Robert learned something. When he was talking to one of the servants, he learned about a woman who lived in New Orleans who was a high priestess of voodoo. And this high priestess had some pretty grand claims. She claimed that she could reanimate the dead. She could take souls who had passed on and put them back in their body and bring back the dead. So Robert found someone who supposedly worked for this high priestess and paid them quite a bit of money, and they agreed to help Robert bring Violet back. So one stormy summer's night, a group of people went into a cemetery, found the grave of little Violet, and began to dig. And soon the grave was unearthed, and a several-month-old corpse was brought out. Well, they brought the corpse back to a certain building where the ritual would take place. Now, Robert was sent home, and he was not allowed to partake in any of this. And he was told that when the ritual is complete, somebody would come to his door and inform him either of its success or of the failure. Well, of course, Robert was on pins and needles. And during this time, as Robert was worrying, the ritual began. Now, here's how traditional zombies work. It's believed that when a person dies, their soul can be trapped. And this soul can be trapped and either kept in a bottle or can be put back into the body. But when it's put back into the body, it's under that person's spell. The high priestess or whoever it is who's doing the voodoo ritual pretty much enslaves that soul. And it can only be broken after that high person has released it or if the soul's job has been completed. Now, here's the thing. This has to happen immediately after death. The soul has to be grabbed before it had time to move on to the spirit realm. Now, little Violet had been dead for quite some months, so you can assume that her little soul had already passed. But the ritual took place, and to everyone's surprise, the corpse was reanimated. And little Violet, not so many hours later, was brought back to her home. And when her father opened the door, he was overjoyed at what he saw, because there was his darling little girl with those bright violet eyes. And he wept, and he ran, and he grabbed his wife, and they were absolutely in love with their daughter once again. Now, here's the thing. It seemed as if they had been put under some sort of odd spell. They were seeing something that nobody else seemed to see. Robert and Yvette saw Violet as she was when she was alive, that perfectly cute little plump girl. But what everybody else saw was something far more sinister. What they saw was a rotting corpse. And in fact, perhaps the ritual wasn't completed properly, or perhaps it was done past the time it should have been. But little Violet's body, the decay process didn't stop. It kept progressing. And after a few months, it was quite a horrific sight. The skin was starting to sink in, the smell was atrocious, and it was honestly not very pleasant to look at. And the servants were all afraid, and some of them left. The few others who were loyal to Yvette and Robert and the memory of Violet began to plot together to do away with what they believed was a demon child. Now, there's another reason that they call this little girl the demon child. Now, the little child that Robert and Yvette saw was their perfect little girl who acted and talked just like their perfect little girl had done in life. But what everybody else saw was something quite sinister. It was something that communicated in strange screeches and growls. It threw the most raging tantrums, but it wasn't like what Violet would throw when she was alive. This was something far more deadly. When this thing would rage and throw a tantrum, it would gash into anything it could find. It would open up deep wounds in the people it attacked, rip into curtains, and even put deep gashes into the walls. Whatever this thing was, this was not Violet. This was something sinister, and this was something that needed to be dealt with. So the nurse set out to get some help. And she eventually found a woman who owned a bit of, you could say, a mediumship. But she did more than just tell fortunes. She also sold tonics and potions and spells, and she seemed to be quite knowledgeable in all things occult. So when the nurse told her what had become of young Violet, the woman told the nurse exactly what she needed to do. She needed to somehow trap this creature. And once the creature was trapped, to bring it back to that store. And when she brought it back, there would be somebody waiting for her who was into voodoo as well. And here's the thing. The person that was going to be retrieving this child, if you want to say, would be the true high priestess of this voodoo. The person who had performed the ritual on Violet was not the real high priestess. In fact, it was one of her underlings. And when the high priestess had heard what had happened, she was furious. And she was very determined to do away with this embarrassment that had happened. So the nurse came back and did as she was told. They eventually found the right opportunity, and they were able to capture little Violet, wrap her up into a gigantic sheet, and drag her away to the store. Now, when the high priestess found this package, she took it away. And the place that she took it to happened to be the home of the person who performed the ritual. And it was agreed that this person would now be in charge of this little creature, and for better or for worse, they would have to do something with it. And that's where the story of Violet ends. As soon as this creature was taken away from the house, the parents, Robert and Yvette, seemed to awaken from their spell. And they had no knowledge, no memory of the reanimation of Violet. And in fact, they seemed to get over their grief after that. And a few months later, Yvette was pregnant again and gave birth to a little boy. And that's where their story leaves us when it comes to history. But there's a little more to Violet. A few years later, in modern times, a couple had moved into a New Orleans house. And when one of the members was remodeling the bathroom, he found something strange. He found up in the ceiling what looked like a little trap door. Now, why on earth anybody would have an attic in the bathroom was beyond him. So he decided to chip away and free this door open and see what was up there. Now, when he told his partner was not exactly happy. In fact, he was very unhappy about the finding of this trapdoor and begged his partner to please leave it alone. Well, the two men argued over this for some time, but eventually the trapdoor was dug out a little. And all that surrounding paint was chipped away, and it was opened. And one of the men crawled inside with a flashlight. And what he saw in there terrified him. inside of the attic, there seemed to be something that looked like an old moldy doll. But when he got closer, he realized this wasn't a doll. This looked like mummified human remains. And these mummified human remains were supposedly that of Violet. Because what they didn't know is the house that they had moved into was the same house that Violet, well, the creature that was now in Violet's body, was left at. The idea of the undead, of zombies, is a very interesting kind of twofold thing. It represents two parts of kind of the human psyche. It represents our fear of death. We're afraid of what death can bring. And it also represents our fear of losing control. Death is the ultimate finality. It's the ultimate moment when we have no say, no control over what happens to us. Well, I want to thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed learning a little extra folklore about the undead.